I'm going to start with a little sadness and ideally end with a bit of joy. The sadness that I noticed as we changed the clocks 6 days ago, that it's been a very bad winter, especially for our community, some really significant deaths in the past winter and over the past year that I think have caused all of us some deep grief. Not that every death isn't significant, but they were many long-term and delightful members, pillars of our community. I wanted to say that. And I also noticed, paradoxically, that the past year has been a year of stretching ourselves in mostly in very good ways. That we as a congregation have done a lot of great stretching. I know for me personally, I've done some good stretching professionally and personally. And I thought about our great good fortune, my great good fortune to be white and upper middle class, that through this COVID period, I've had time to introspect and reflect. But people of different socioeconomic standing, typically people of different race, have not had the same experience. I have a close friend, some of you may know from the university, Tyvee Small, who has had several COVID and COVID-related deaths in his family, including his mother and her brothers and sisters who live in rural Florida. So it has not been an easy time, and I just want to put all of those broad, paradoxical, and sometimes abstract sentiments on the table. Though, as a singer says, after winter must come spring. I'll get there. So, why do I find this week's Haftarah so amusing? One might imagine that there was an idol makers local 710. I wonder about the lives of idol makers. The Haftarah mocks them as taking the same materials they cook their bread and meat on and using it to make these fetishes and idols. So I wonder about their lives. Was idol making a lucrative endeavor? Was it a cottage industry? What was their quality of life? Were they unionized? Did they have benefits? Obviously, they didn't truly have benefits. But the economics of idol making is something I've wanted to address several years going, and I haven't had an opportunity to. Interestingly, at this time, I've been reading Isabel Wilkerson's Cast. I'm about two-thirds of the way through, and it's not so novel for me to say I'm reading it. Everybody's reading it. It describes the history of race in America through the shared lens of caste in India, and somewhat accurately, the lens of caste in Nazi Germany. But I think one could make a broader conception of the lens of caste as regards to Jews and Roma. In Europe, and how, like African Americans in America, in the United States, forming the underclass, the lowest caste, along with Native Americans, which she doesn't address, Jews in Europe, through most of Europe's history, were the bottom class and caste. And I think when we look at violence against Asian Americans in the recent days, and even anti-Zionism, where it blends into anti-Semitism, it's about caste. In a lot of ways, it's about the economics of finding people to do the dirty tasks that the people in the upper castes and, to an extent, upper class and privileged races don't want to do. Nail polishing, peddling, money lending, cobbling, latrine cleaning in India. And anti-Zionism becomes a sort of caste resistance, just as seeing Barack Obama, himself part of the unfavored caste in America, rise to the heights of strength and authority. Seeing Jews have their own successful country at some degree must really frustrate the caste perceptions of Europeans and others. So I want to use a bit of that economic and race language and lens to talk through this week's parasha and the ways in which we all participate in an economic system that gets the dirty jobs done. Whether it was Chinese immigrants doing the dangerous work of building the railroads, or Mexican immigrants or African American slaves doing difficult farm labor, or in an experience I'm very embarrassed to admit, I don't recall if it was, I think it was off Cedar Bluff interchange, seeing some people do some dangerous yard work at the edge of the interstate, and thinking to myself, oh, it feels okay because they're Latino immigrants. Was it subconscious? I'm not saying I agree with that as a ethical statement. I just noticed it in myself. So we all participate in this convenient system that idol makers like cobblers or cleaners or household workers are of a people that we don't recognize, of a people that we see as other. And although many people don't want to hear this, we all are implicated in it. We are none of us pure. The word tamim is used in the third verse of this new book of the Bible, new book of Torah, but it's used repeatedly. It means roughly pure or simple. And Rav Asi in Midrash says that, he doesn't say only, but I think his point is only young children are pure. The rest of us are not like the korbanot pure. The rest of us are not tam or tamim, only the youngest of children. They sleep the sleep of the innocent, to quote a coworker once. And we all have, to use a term in chapter 4 of Leviticus, unwitting guilt. Things we're part of by nature of our status, race, economic bearing, generation of immigration, country of ethnic origin, participation, parents, educational attainment, zip code. We are all pieces of an unwitting system. One of my most interesting mitzvot that begins to be described in this parsha is called me'ila, misuse of sacred goods, which I thought to myself once is what it means when the rabbi or anyone scarfs down food at Kiddush. The Kiddush is intended to be a sacred fellowship, and if you just look at it as some pickles and bagels, you're misusing the sacred. So that's what me'ila is, being remiss about God's sacred things. And that's the nature of so many transgressions, at least as described in this parasha, that many of the things we do wrong are just unwitting, are simple, are small oversights and little harms, little mistakes, subconscious acts, like me seeing those immigrants working at the roadway. It wasn't a conscious thought that they should be only allowed to do that. It was a strange relief that they didn't look like me. And then there are acts of omission that the parsha speaks against. If you hear a public imprecation, probably meaning someone cursing God's name or offering a vow falsely, you're warranted to testify. And the beginning of chapter 5 of Leviticus says, if you don't testify, then you will carry the iniquity. And the verbal structure is a little odd. Maybe it means the iniquity, the transgression of the person whom you are could have testified against. You, as an unbearing witness, as a witness who does not step forward, how many of those do we know in the world? A witness who does not step forward, or an eyewitness with false information or unverifiable information, you are part of the problem. That silence is violence, to quote South Park. And to go to a more serious source, the Talmud in Shabbat says that the righteous are accountable if they could protest and did not. I think we are all looking around the room, looking around the virtual room, among the righteous, or would like to be, and strive to be, at the very least. We strive to be the decent, the menschlich, the kind, the generous. But we are all, honestly, part of the caste system, part of a system of economic hierarchies that ensure that our dishes get washed at restaurants, that our nails are done for a low price, that we honestly, in the past year, get all of our goods and boxes from Amazon. As we're finding out more and more, Amazon workers are worked to the bone. And we have all, I imagine, been unwitting participants in that economic endeavor. And those are often people of rural background, people of lower castes, whether by ethnic origin or by racial, so to speak, origin, or by geographic origin. We're all participating in an economic system that is unavoidably problematic. There's just no way around it. And no one's found a way until they mechanize Amazon to take away those hard factory jobs. And so we think about our role as consumers, our role as participants, and most of all, I think our role as consumers. The Midrash, when looking at the verse on people who don't testify, offers a beautiful parable. I'm going to share it with you. I've been looking for an opportunity to share this parable for years. There was once a governor who used to put to death the purchasers of stolen goods and release the thieves. The purchasers of stolen good and release the thieves. You see this sometimes in issues around prostitution, for example, punishing the people who solicit prostitutes, not the prostitutes themselves. So this governor would put to death the purchasers and release the thieves themselves, and everyone would complain about that. Everyone would find fault with the governor, saying he was not acting correctly. What did he do? He issued a proclamation throughout the province saying, everyone go out to the plaza, everyone go out to the arena, probably is what the Hebrew word has in mind. So he brought some weasels and put portions of food in the center of this arena or plaza or gaga pit. The weasels took the portions and carried them to their weasel holes. The next day he issued a proclamation, everyone come back to the campus, to the arena. Again, he brought weasels and placed portions of food before them, but stoppered the holes. The weasels took their portions and carried them to the holes, but finding those stopped up, they brought their portions back to the middle. Thus he demonstrated that so much of the trouble is due to the receivers. Notwithstanding the fact that I can't imagine a weasel, like our dog, not enjoying food just because he couldn't have it in his customary place. The metaphor falls down a little bit, but the point being very clear that the recipient, the consumer, the beneficiary of a caste system or inequity is no less excused than any other part. So I said, after winter must come spring, and out of sorrow must come joy, we hope, and out of struggle and out of inequity must come growth and wholeness. So that's where I want to end with you. With a quote, especially, that I just found this week that's perfect. So we have in Parshat Leviticus, Parshat Vayikra, the system of repair and amends. We call it kapara, same root as Yom Kippur. A way to make amends, a way to make repair. So the first step is hitvada, or litvadot, is to make acknowledgement, to make known, to acknowledge, to accept. We have to, perhaps just to one other person, perhaps publicly, acknowledge and account for, be accountable to our own participation that we have, I imagine, looking around the virtual room at so many menschlich and decent and striving to be great faces, all but things from Amazon this year. And many of those things were on 1 or 2 day shipping. And you can only imagine the exhaustion of a package worker in an Amazon facility to get you your grapes. I don't know what people buy. Sometimes people buy $10 items that arrive next day. Salt. I know someone who bought salt. And then we do reparation, what's called asham, the sacrifice of reparation, in chapter 5 of Leviticus. There is some work to be done, not just some, but a lot of work. That I think by nature of society and the way economies are constructed, and in general, I'm a free market capitalist. In general, I approve of most of the things that Adam Smith and Milton Friedman advocated. It's an unequal system and has a lot of inherent jagged edges that we have to work for. So if after winter comes spring, then part of the solution to all this is love and wholeness, and seeing those in different caste or class or skin tone to ourselves as no less human than we are, and recognizing that some people have to do the dirty jobs, but that doesn't make them dirty people. Abraham Isaac Cook, this is the new quotation I love this week, said that love in the soul of the righteous embraces all creatures, it excludes nothing, and no people or tongue. Love in the soul of the righteous embraces all creatures, excludes nothing, no people, nor tongue. We'd like to imagine, and I think the Reform movement takes us a little too far, that Judaism is a universalist faith. It is not. It is quite often very particularist. And in the traditional vein, this is one of the rare times you can hear an extremely highly regarded Orthodox rabbi note that we ought to be equally accepting of all people and tongues. That clearly embraces more creatures than just your fellow Jew. So concluding with this week's parasha, the most common sacrifice described and offered would have been the zevach shlamim, the whole sacrifice, from the same root as completeness, or we often translate as peace or harmony, shalom, shin lamed mem, to be whole, to be gathered together. Torat Kohanim notices this etymology, Torat Kohanim being the Midrash on Leviticus, and asks, why is it called a peace offering? Now, it's not going to say peace in the Hebrew. Shalom doesn't just mean peace. I want to underline that. Because everyone partakes of it. The blood and fat go to the altar, the breast and the thigh to the priest, and the hide and flesh to the owner. It is completely shared and completely used and completely accounted for. And all parts matter. Living in what will forever be a system that can only strive for justice and equity, but never truly arrive. Let us at least take this Shabbat after a cold and sometimes dark winter and after an extended period of quarantine and suffering that has reached some of us more than others. Let us return to an awareness, or at least grow in our awareness, that we are all whole, that we are all one human family, that all creatures are deserving of love and compassion, and that no creature is fit to do the dirty jobs, but sometimes they need to be done. And to have love that embraces all creatures excludes nothing.